Okay, hello everyone. I assume that you can hear me. Okay, good. And I hope, Regina, that you said, you were turning the mic over to me. I was chatting with Craig and kind of missed my cue. So I hope that I have not prematurely taken the mic. Welcome everyone to Awakening Together's monthly satsang. This month's guest is Craig Holiday. Craig is a gifted meditation and spiritual teacher trained in both the yogic and Buddhist traditions and is a licensed professional counselor. Excuse me. Pardon me. Craig travels frequently offering non-dual meditation workshops, retreats, and satsang. Craig presents on spiritual topics at the Science and Non-Duality Conference, yoga festivals, churches, and Dharma centers. He is the author of Fully Human, Fully Divine, and has been featured on the popular YouTube show Buddha at the Gas Pump. His work is dedicated to the discovery of our innate divinity and the expansion of compassionate action. He works in a way that addresses our everyday suffering as a doorway to our inherent freedom and empowerment. He meets with individuals locally at his office in Durango, Colorado, and with individuals from around the world on Skype. So welcome, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Craig, normally what I do when I am talking to teachers such as yourself is have them tell us a little bit about themselves. So if it's okay with you, we'll start there.
Yeah, I mean, what do you want to know about me? I can talk for hours, about my life and then, you know, different teachers I've had and experiences and... I can talk about being a therapist and being a father and, you know, the trials I've gone through. So it would be helpful if you you steered me a little bit.
Well, I think that I appreciate that. Let me ask them first. Are you guys hearing Craig as well as me when we speak? Yes. Okay, good. I think that it's just helpful for those of us who don't feel that we've yet reached enlightenment or awakening, that sort of thing, to hear about the journey, the spiritual journey
sure.
of others. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So that's I can start with that.
Thank you.
So as a young child, I always had a deep love and reverence for God. I just had just this open heart towards God, and it took no thought and no effort. I grew up in a Midwestern family. My father had a military background, and so he ran a pretty tight ship at the house. I had a mother who was who's just absolutely wonderful, and she was there most of the time with us, raising us. And you know, we lived out in the country and played in the woods, and we'd go to church on Sunday. And I can remember, I've spoken to a lot of people about this, but for me as a child, I just loved Jesus. I loved the Catholic Church. And so many people I know, they've experienced, trauma with the Catholic Church, and all this guilt and just experiences of abuse. I can even say that my father, even though he loves the church, that he was probably a victim of the church. He grew up in going to Catholic school and experienced all kinds of brutal things there. And honestly, so did my mother, whether it's being beaten and abused by the nuns or my father with, inappropriate things possibly happening with the priest. But they had a love and a respect for the church, and, you know, they, you know, followed the dogma of the church. But me as a child, I would just walk into the church and my heart would light up. I would have no idea at all what the priest was speaking about, no concept of what it was. But when I would look down at the priest, I would just have this sense that, you know, when I say look down, I mean, you know, if we were sitting up higher, like in the balcony or something, or just in the cathedral, there was just a feeling of divinity there. And that's, you know, what God was for me. I never, to be honest, I haven't even ever read the Bible in its entirety. I've read some of the books within it, but or some of the Gospels within it. But my heart was just open to Christ, and it just seemed like there was this natural love and faith and trust in God. And so, you know, that just continued, you know, on throughout my life. And I've always had that connection. You know, even now as I, you know, speak about God or speak about divinity, my heart lights up. You know, I feel this grace coming into me, just speaking of a love of God. And as a spiritual teacher, it surprised me, because I came to realize that, you know, very few people have that experience that I had, and I just had it. You know, just kind of came into this world with this. So many people I talk to, when I speak about God, they get nervous, they get angry. When I talk about Christ, you know, they, you know, start to think of the Catholic Church and all the trauma they experienced. And, you know, to me, you know, that's just politics, and politics can happen with the church. It can happen with Donald Trump, with Hillary Clinton, with, you know, a school system. It has nothing to do with God. That has to do with, you know, human beings and our own nature. And so, when I was, you know, 14 or 15, I remember, being in a high school class, and I, you know, it was like environmental studies or something. And, you know, the teacher said, he just said like three things in a day. He said, vegetarianism, Buddhism, and yoga. And just right away, my heart lit up again. And without question, I just, you know, became a vegetarian. And, you know, I just considered myself a, you know, a student of Buddhism, a student of yoga. And of course, my love for Christ absolutely continued. And there was no sense of there being any problem, with that. And so about age 18 or 19, I moved out of the house, basically hopped in a car with some friends and moved out west. And so I was, you know, kind of living in the, you know, Cincinnati, Ohio area, and lived in Kentucky. And as a kid, spent a lot of time, I guess my whole life there. And then just got in the car one day. We just moved out to Colorado, and I went to college, and I needed a job. And, you know, I answered an ad, you know, which just said, you know, a laborer is needed. And so when I answered that ad, I didn't realize it, but right away I met my spiritual teacher, David. And I was with him for, you know, a good part of 20 years. You know, so I had intense training with him. He was a full spiritual master. I mean, he was an individual who could command grace in a room. Like, sometimes people would walk in the room with him and they would faint. Wow. Because the amount of grace that was present. And, but he's not the kind of person who likes to have a big public persona. He doesn't have a website. He's not out there in the world. I mean, I don't even use his last name because he doesn't like to be contacted by people. Just has a small group of students in Colorado. And then he used to live in New York City and San Francisco. And so he had students there. He'd kind of fly back and forth, but spent most of his time in Colorado. And so I worked with him, you know, building a retreat center, and I did, you know, 40 or 50 retreats with him, and built a temple, and, you know, built all the gardens, and had a very traditional guru-apprentice relationship. I mean, he never called himself a guru, but, you know, you looked at him and you just knew. I mean, you felt this huge presence all around him, and he was a man, or is a man, of incredible integrity. And so I just, that just like fell into my lap, you know? And so he was like a second father to me. And I mean, I could talk for hours about him and, you know, the grace that came with him and the, you know, the path that he presented, but, maybe you should ask me some more questions about, what specifically.
I just want to comment on just how amazing it is. You and I were talking about this a little bit, about just how grace works. And it's just so cool that you answer a seemingly random ad and find your teacher.
It was amazing. It's funny because he told me he recently moved to Colorado. He probably moved there the exact same time I moved there. And, he bought a piece of land and it had a house on it and a barn. And it was like 20 acres backed up on the side of a mountain, just backed up to, Bureau of Land Management land, which is basically the national parks or, federal land. You know, out in Colorado where I live, I'm 4 hours from a city, so it's mountains and trees and deserts and in all different directions. And so he had a bunch of different people work for him, and then finally he said they were all terrible, and he said a prayer to God, like, God, send me the right person. And I showed up the next day, and, you know, there it was. But it was funny because, you know, I had no idea what I was getting into, but it was exactly perfect. And my heart just lit up, and it just felt like, like when you meet an old friend, from a previous lifetime, when it's just like everything clicks and falls into place. And so, it was that grace, and I was carried and in so many ways. And he, he's one of these individuals who, I'd spend like 40 hours a week working with him at his house, side by side. And he would be training me and, just being very precise. He's a very precise teacher, which is the opposite of my nature. I'm very loose and carefree, and he's very exact. But, he would walk me through, all these different heaven worlds, and, the experiences of grace with him were so profound. I tell people the most pain and the most bliss I've ever experienced were in his presence. It was just sometimes the intensity of light is almost too much for an individual to handle. And, there'd be times when I would just want to run out of the room screaming because it was so brilliant, so intense. It'd feel as if my, all my chakra centers from the inside out was going to burn up in light. And so there was times like that, and there were times when, it felt like you were just floating in the most, gentle of peace or gentle of heaven. And it was incredible. And it was funny because in the town I live in, it was very much a Buddhist town. And so if I talked to my Buddhist friends about grace, that wasn't a part of their experience. And so they quickly dismissed that and had no interest. And my teacher, I thought, my God, you're missing this living saint, who's in our presence. But I think my teacher kind of liked it that way. He didn't like a lot of people around him. He didn't like a lot of, that spiritual circus that can form around great teachers. And so we had this very wonderful and intimate relationship. And so any question I had, he would just answer it even before I would ask.
Right.
Sometimes, if I wasn't in his presence, I was driving down the road and I was struggling with something, he would call me, and, I saw the phone light up with his number, and I just pull over, and I'd feel the transmission of grace coming through him, and he would answer the question or give me advice on something I hadn't even asked for. And it was one of those wonderful relationships, and he in a sense trained me in being able to work with individuals where you can feel into an individual and notice what's happening in the different chakra centers and, help individuals open and be receptive in this way. And so a lot of the people that are attracted to working with me, they like to have that experience of, having a teacher, having someone, and I'll say this, someone who's ordinary, because, I don't present myself as a guru or anything you know, silly like that. I like to be approachable. I like it that, you know, my students have my phone number. I like it that they can send me an email. And, you know, at 10:30 on a Friday night, I might answer it, you know, and they might have to wait till Monday. But, right. You know, I have people that call me all the time, and you know, sometimes I get a little bit overwhelmed by it, because I get so many emails and so many questions and can't get to them all. But the, you know, I deeply value having a teacher. And I've noticed that a lot of people in the non-dual world don't value having a teacher.
Or maybe don't have the opportunity. Go ahead.
Say that again.
Or maybe don't have the opportunity to have a teacher.
Sure. And they, you know, oftentimes, you know, we've seen so many gurus fail. We've seen so many great teachers fail. And as students, oftentimes we have this, maybe a false view of what enlightenment is. And we project that onto a human individual and demand total perfection. And hell, that's a rare thing in an individual. It's a rare thing for anyone to keep up. And I'll say, it's even an impossibility, because God created an evolutionary world. And so every individual is going to have their evolving edge. And so as students, we should know that. As teachers, we should know that as well, that we have an evolutionary nature. And that's, you know, I look at God as, you know, that, you know, two great experiences, the experience of vast, spacious emptiness. And that's what we focus on in, you know, the teachings of Buddhism. And oftentimes the teachings of non-duality, you know, in the Vedic worlds, we focus on, you know, the vast spacious emptiness, the pristine absolute, you know, our unborn nature, that innate perfection. So that's true. And I like to look at that, like when I look up at the vast expanse of the night sky where I live, it's like you can see just stars in every direction. And so to me, the vast expanse of nature is like the darkness of space. It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. It's unborn. It's unmanifest. There's nothing, you know, about it that needs to be changed or improved, or you could even imagine, like, what would it mean to improve space? It's, you know, it's ineffable. And so there's that. So that's, you know, one experience of God. And oftentimes we think of that as like God the Father, but then God the Mother, what was this dynamic flow of creation? You know, it's this expressiveness, this explosiveness, this creativity, this being incarnated into form. And so, you know, we need to have a relationship with both. You know, I see a lot of individuals from the non-dual world just focusing on vast spacious emptiness,
right,
just focusing on transcending. And, you know, they think they're transcending and including, but oftentimes they're transcending and excluding their lives, their partners, their children, you know, their careers. They become ungrounded, get themselves in all kinds of trouble from just, you know, trying to live in the vast spaciousness and not honoring our incarnated life, where things are ever evolving. So there is a saying, you know, in defense of Buddhism, there's that old saying, let's see if I can remember it now. Being Buddha, it's like always being Buddha, and then always becoming Buddha.
Mm, right.
You know, and it's necessary that we realize both. You know, the nature of our innate perfection, which is spacious in every moment. And then simultaneously, that we're always evolving. Our human form is always evolving. Yeah. And I'll even go as far as say, you know, of course the earth is evolving. I got in a little bit of an argument, you know, with another non-dual teacher about, well, is God evolving? And I say, yeah. Well, absolutely. That God is evolving too. He said, well, how could God evolve? You know, God is, you know, vast, spacious emptiness. I'm like, well, yeah, so that's one experience. But God is evolving in form. And to me, that's the next stage of our evolution. You know, we're growing out of, you know, being an animal being, you know, into, say, being human beings. And then the next step is growing into, like, a spiritual and light being. And so in the lineage that I came from, the Sri Aurobindo lineage, places a lot of emphasis on evolving the body, evolving the mind, evolving our egoic nature. And so to me, I always see that everything within us is a work in progress. Everything within us is a stepping stone. You know, so I don't see the mind as something that's bad. I don't see the ego as something that's bad. I don't see anger as something as bad. You know, to me, anger, you know, it's an animal emotion. But as we work with it, as it evolves, you know, and there's all those tantric teachings about working with anger. Anger evolves into swift action. It evolves into power.
Right.
It evolves into, you know, this incredible presence. You know, and so it's very important that we don't just transcend and ignore.
Right. And
but we learn to work with these things within us. And notice that God didn't make anything in this world by mistake. The ego's not a mistake. You know, our humanity's not a mistake. Our animal nature
right.
is not a mistake. Desire is not a mistake. Nothing is a mistake. But they're all just lower forms that are evolving into a greater form of divine expression. And then, of course, the question for us on the path is, are we connected in a healthy way to our evolutionary nature? And are we connected to our heart? And can we allow our heart to transmit itself through something like the experience of anger? When our heart transmits through, you know, anger, it transforms anger into, you know, positive, you know, compassionate action on the planet. But it's the kind of compassionate action, you know, of like, say, Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Christ. You know, where we're standing for truth. You know, were those individuals angry? Absolutely. There's many instances in the Bible where Christ was furious, you know, and, you know, people think that, well, if I'm enlightened, I'll never experience anger again. I say, you're crazy. Like, Christ was angry. You think you're not going to experience anger? You know, we have too many. We have too many statues of Buddha just sitting there in meditation, you know, but, I mean, hell, you know, one form of Buddha sitting in meditation, you know, is him, yes, experiencing peace in every direction and being totally and completely unmoved. But another experience, you know, is someone like Thich Nhat Hanh,
yeah.
you know, whose whole life is a movement of compassion, where he's building and creating in the world, where he's standing up, you know, to injustice in the world. He's standing for truth. And, you know, it takes someone who's in touch with those qualities, you know, who's really worked with themselves in a way, so that, you know, they can manifest something greater in this world.
Well, and I appreciate that. And again, the name of Craig's book is Fully Human, Fully Divine. And of course, the reason that I mentioned it here, by the way, you answered every question that I had, you answered in that 5 minutes.
Wow.
So I think we'll kind of go back and look at some of those topics more closely.
Sure.
One of them that I want to get back to in a minute is this idea of transcendence, and for me that's where you seem to distinguish yourself from many of the other teachers that we see. The idea that we are both fully human, fully divine.
Yeah.
Having said that, I want to look at a couple of other issues first. First of all, it's
well, now don't confuse me. Don't bring something up and don't talk about it.
Well, I'm afraid if we talk about that we'll spend 90 minutes talking about that.
Okay,
and we won't.
Okay, you tell me what you want to speak about that.
If I don't get back to that, you just bring it up.
I know,
well,
my mind can only hold one thing at a time. So.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to ask you because I hear your Catholic background, and I hear you talk about God from a very Christian position. And so I appreciated when you went into the discussion of God as, you know, spaciousness and seeing God in the sky and that sort of thing, God the Father and God the Mother. But it's very non-traditional in the non-dual community to speak of God in these, it sounds like anthropomorphic terms, like God wants this. I noticed that you said that in your book.
Sure.
God wants us to evolve and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So I just wanted to...
Well, it's not that God wants us to evolve. God is evolution itself.
Okay. All right.
You know, it's like God is evolution. You know, people can say it's untraditional, say, from a non-dual perspective. But, you know, like when I went to Ramana Ashram in India, you know, Ramana Maharshi, he worshipped Arunachala, the mountain.
Yeah.
He bowed before it. You know, and he spoke with the Divine Mother often. I mean, he would bow and you could feel the presence, you know, of that mountain. You feel the presence of it. But simultaneously, like when you're, so you feel the presence of it being alive and powerful and filled with Shakti, you know, as you're walking up it. But simultaneously, as you're, you know, as you're doing the pilgrimage up the mountain, you feel the mountain just expanding and becoming greater and greater and more spacious and infinite. And it's this amazing experience. I think any great non-dual teacher, you know, knows that non-dual is totally inclusive of everything, of absolutely everything. And too oftentimes, you know, sometimes I get these emails from the non-dual police trying to correct me and very much limit the experience of non-duality. And of course, you know, when we talk about the mother and the father, and, you know, it's like, even as say, if I was a feminist, you know, who thought, okay, you can't talk about the Father God. And I don't think there's any feminist who really thinks that someone actually believes that the Father God has, you know, a penis. You know, it's like no one really thinks that. You'd have to be you know, just completely crazy to have, you know, even to have thought that God has genitals. But it's more just that sense of, you know, as human beings, we think of, you know, God in the masculine, you know,
right.
What's the experience of that? And that's, you know, so often in the non-dual world, it's the vast spacious emptiness, the transcendent experience of God. And then, you know, in the feminine, you know, it's like that experience of creative evolution. And the intelligence of it too, you know, it's Satchitananda, it's the full experience. They really can't be separated. You can feel into the differences. It kind of resonate with one quality more so than another. But if you feel into them, they're both there. You know, in Buddhism, they talk about vast spacious emptiness, the Prajnaparamita, which, you know, is an expression of the Divine Mother. And so here's, you know, some old school Buddhism. It's pregnant with all phenomena.
Mm.
Pregnant with all phenomena. And so it's like, if you look at space, what is all that dark matter?
Mm-hmm.
It's pregnant. It's continually giving birth. You know, it's like, if you look at us, it's like, it's given birth to us. And of course, we are not separate from it. It would be crazy to even try to imagine how we are separate from it. I mean, how we can just ask that question of, you know, what is it within us that's alive? You know, like, what is it? What is this radiance, this aliveness within me? What is this aliveness in this form? One movement of life, one movement of grand intelligence.
Yeah.
So I can't even remember what your question was.
I can't even rack and feel that, so thank you.
Excuse me if I got off. Got off track, but I do remember it was speaking about, you know, this being an untraditional approach. I think if a teacher lives long enough, and hell, I'm not even that old, but if a teacher lives long enough, their experience of non-duality becomes quite mature and quite inclusive. My main teacher is David, and my other main teacher would be Adya. And so I had this question with Adya, and we were talking about, you know, different teachers and how people teach. And, you know, he said this interesting thing to me. He said, you know, Craig, if you're a teacher and you just focus on one thing, like just on transcendence, then your power of transmission of that world is incredible. And so there's certain teachers, you know, say like Eckhart Tolle. I mean, Adya, all he does is, you know, speak about awakening, I mean, for the most part. And so he can speak about this one teaching and it can be transmitted in such a powerful way And it's incredible. It has incredible effect on his students. I mean, it has had incredible effect on me personally.
Right.
But the mistake oftentimes that people make is they think that the teacher, when they give up, you know, stand up there, you know, sit there on their lion throne and give the satsang, you know, you know, the students make the mistake of thinking, okay, what he or she says during this 1 hour, 2 hour period is the complete and total truth because it feels that way.
Right. Yes.
But as a teacher, if you ever pull a teacher aside and be like, hey, like, I mean, is that really the totality? You know, of course they're going to say no. Yeah. I mean, if they have any maturity about them.
Well, in fact, what I've heard you talk about or seen you talk about in your book and, is the mistake that we often make in that we see some end point when we see these teachers talking about a certain aspect of awakening. We think awakening ends.
Yeah, it seems like that. But if you, you know, and so let me see if I can just finish that. So
sure.
With that, there's a power in just teaching about one thing, you know, and so say, for example, I mean, I'm friends with so many different teachers, but one time, Bentinho Massaro had me over for dinner, and he's teaching. It's like right now, all he's teaching about is abundance and manifesting a life of your dreams connected, you know, with your heartfelt desire. And so he teaches it. He focuses in on it with laser-like precision. And so he's broadcasting that to his audience.
Yes.
And so it's very powerful in his presence, like when you're around him. Me, I do the total opposite. I work with anything and everything. I work with all the layers of human existence. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a teacher who's living in a monastery or who's, you know, living a celibate life. I mean, I lived a celibate life at one point, but, you know, I don't want to get into that in this moment. I'm a teacher who has a family, who has children, who's been through divorce, who's, you know, who's failed at business, who's been, you know, betrayed and, you know, by friends and family and, you know, who's experienced the messiness of life,
mm-hmm.
who works in the world of psychology. And so I like to meet individuals in their humanity and use that as a doorway, you know, into their divinity. One of the great mistakes I made for, you know, the good part of 15 years was I came into this lifetime with such a strong monk archetype. You know, like I have had lifetimes of being a monk, like just dreams and just memory after memory of being a monk. And so when I came into this world, I had intense division about, you know, God, you know, just lives in the church, or God just lives in the sky. God is just, you know, in the spiritual traditions, you have to be living at the feet of the guru. You know, I mean, I spent my life building a retreat center for my teacher. All I wanted to do was be there, meditate all day, work with him, do seva. And so to me, you know, God was only there. It took me a long time, you know, and I did tremendous violence to my body, to my mind, trying to get rid of Craig, the person. And it backfired. I could never get rid of him. And I realized the more I tried to get rid of him, the more I tried to transcend him, the more pain I caused myself. And also, the more split off I became from my humanity. And so I had this experience of being able to experience incredible spiritual states through meditation. But then I'd come home, like to my first wife, and be a total jerk. You know,
yeah.
And I had a 5-year-old, you know, that she, that I adopted, you know, from that marriage. And, you know, I wasn't a kind and loving father to the son. You know, I wanted to ignore him and just meditate or tell him to be quiet so I could meditate. And that wasn't right. It's not right to, you know, just to try to discover God, you know, when we have ourselves closed in our little meditation closet. That's not an act of love or compassion. And at some point along the way, you know, I just continually tried to get rid of myself and had this inner hatred towards myself, towards my mind, you know. And so naturally I fell in love with those teachings that there's no one here, I'm nobody, you know, the ego is not real. But it backfired tremendously. And, you know, I can say this. It worked for a period of time, but then it backfired. And I get a lot of people, you know, who've done the, you know, who've asked the question, you know, who am I?
Right.
And then they experience that sense of, oh, there's nobody here. But then they go through a divorce, or they lose their job, or they end up, you know, going from having $1 million to being homeless. And then, you know, they find themselves, you know, reaching out for someone like me, like, Craig, what the hell, you know, what has happened here? I say, well, you have a huge shadow. You have a huge shadow, and we're going to talk about that. And our work is to integrate that and to see, you know, that God made something beautiful in you. You are a work of divine intelligence. And to really connect with your heart, with your presence, with your innocence, with that which is good within you. And, you know, a better question than who am I is how can I live from this place of truth?
Yeah.
Or if I ask the question, who am I, can I find that sense of innocence and beauty? And that radiance, you know, that's looking out of your eyes. What does that radiance want to say? What does it want to do? How does it want to interact in the world? You know, versus how can I just escape my humanity? And I can tell you, I tried incredibly hard to escape. And my humanity, it just kept coming back again and again and again. But the more I worked with it, the more I realized, oh, this humanity, it's not a mistake. My ego is not a mistake. My ego is an incredibly well-crafted piece of technology. It keeps us safe. And well, hell, when it's out of control, it makes us aggressive and rude and mean and self-centered and all that kind of silliness. But when we really work with our ego, we see it's a gift from God to protect us from harm. When we work with our emotions, we see that, oh, they grow into incredible experiences of divinity. You know, but it's unfortunate, but most of our spirituality is, you know, 1,000 years old, 2,000 years old, you know, and 2,000 years ago, it's like, hell yeah, get me off this planet because life is suffering. You know, let me just go into a world where I don't have to come back and toil again as a farmer. You know, it's brutal. You know, and of course, life still is brutal. But, you know, this, we don't have to escape it. And as we start to have more of an evolutionary worldview, we begin to see that God is evolution. We see that we are evolving into something. Whereas the old way, you know, is just like, you know, get me to heaven.
Yeah.
You know, I met a pastor once. I was doing some work at a nursing home. I just asked him, you know, like, hey, pastor, how you doing? You know, he said, one day closer to heaven. And I was like, shit, I guess that's one way of looking at this world. One day closer to heaven, you know? But, you know, to me, if I'm at the nursing home and I'm, you know, holding cards for these old ladies with these frail hands, you know, if I look into their eyes, I see this absolute divinity pouring out. If I even look into their hands that are kind of mangled and they can't even hold the cards, I have to hold the cards for them. I see this radiance coming off their skin, this aliveness, this divinity, this presence. And so that's something quite wonderful, quite profound. You know, I'm not going to go into a place like that and dismiss the divinity that's present.
Well, and so, and you talk in your book about three stages of enlightenment and the transcendental awakening being the first of those stages. You say that second stage is the awakening of our heart, and then there's the final liberation. So it's this progression that you're talking about now. Is that correct?
Sure, and so I'm glad you brought me back to that because there is tremendous value in transcendence. Transcendence is a stepping stone. And so, you know, for you know, a good part of the 20 years I was with my teacher David, it was a progressive path. Every day we were working with a level of our being. Or sometimes we'd spend, you know, weeks or months working on one you know, really persistent, you know, level within our egoic nature, within our, you know, emotional mind or our mental mind, just working with it, trying to help to open it and to transform it into something greater. And so I had that experience with him of just like that absolute progressiveness of the path. And then simultaneously, I was studying with Ajahn Shanti, you know, and, you know, it's just like I can remember, it was actually even before I met him, I was driving to one of his satsangs, or it's a weekend intensive, and Colorado's it's a massive state, and so it was, you know, about a 7-hour drive for me, and I had to drive across, if you ever drive across Colorado, it's so beautiful.
But yes, yeah.
I was dropping into the San Luis Valley. It's this massive valley. And all of a sudden, just out of me, just, you know, it just felt like this tremendous sadness came forward. And it just started to, you know, just like empty out of me, just these tears, these incredible tears came. And then it was like, you know, and I was driving the car and the person with me, with you, should you be driving? And then, you know, this, all of a sudden there was just this, just explosion, you know, of my mind, where it was like, you know, normally as a human individual, it seems like you're just stuck in your head. You're stuck in your body and you're limited to this form. Well, in, you know, just a moment, it felt as if I was as big as the San Luis Valley. And this is just like this huge, massive opening occurred. And that's the experience of the transcendent, the experience of being everything, just vast spaciousness.
Wow.
I can't even just convey the hugeness of this valley. It's just, you know, grand mountains on both sides, and it just, you know, when you look at it, it will stop you in your tracks. It's so big. So there's this feeling of just being so incredibly huge, and that, you know, as if nothing mattered, as if time had suddenly stopped forever. You know, and there was just, you know, one little voice in it, because I think I asked a question. What should I do? I was thinking about the marriage, you know, that I was recently going through a divorce in. And there was just a sense of just like, just let go. And it wasn't even like let go of the marriage. It was like let go of everything. And so in that moment, you know, it felt like, my God, that who and what I am is so huge, so profoundly vast. I mean, it just continued in a sense to this day, but, in a real profound way for a good part of a year and a half. And it left me just laying on a couch in my backyard. I had a porch with a couch on it, and I just watched the trees blow in the wind and the birds fly through the sky, and just had the sense of like the birds are flying through me. And so with that experience of transcendence is that feeling that, yes, all is well. Like, everything is okay and completely and totally perfect right now, 100% as it is. You know, there's that old saying, nothing to do, nowhere to go, no one to be. And so, yeah, I did that and went from having little money to being completely and utterly broke, you know, having to sell off, you know, everything I owned, because in a sense, like I had a hard time even working, because there was like no mind to think. But simultaneously, hell, I had children to raise, you know, so the kids would come and kind of jab me in my belly, say, hey, Dad, you know.
Is anybody home?
Dinner. Yeah. You know, can you take me here or there? And, you know, it was an interesting time because it was just a sense of like space was just like, I am space.
Wow.
And most people, you know, most people have a non-dual awakening. That's the first stage. I am space. Mm-hmm. Most people make this mistake of saying, and this is all there is. And I am the totality of existence. And then, you know, their ego co-opts it and they latch onto it and they argue from that place and they create a whole identity
right.
on defending spaciousness.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, people have to go through that phase. I've always been, I have such a broad mind and broad experience that I couldn't, it's hard for me to ever nail any one thing down and say this is the totality. Even though it feels like it's the totality, and this is a conversation I had with Adya, you know, it's like things can feel like they're the totality, but they're not.
Right.
You know, just because something feels a certain way doesn't make it true. And that's like the non-dual fallacy out there. Is that, well, it feels like there's no ego. It feels like I don't exist. You know, it's like, it feels like you don't exist, but you're talking to me. Like, what the hell's that? You know, like, come on. Like, if I slap you in the face or choke you out, you know, you're going to find your existence real quick. And so I like to be blunt with people. And you know, and you know, you can only live in the transcendent for so long, unless you live in a monastery, or unless it is your karma, you know, like someone like Eckhart Tolle, you know, and it very much in a sense, it's his karma to teach from that place, but even him has, even he has become more grounded, and you know, he wrote New Heaven, New Earth, and talk about the experience of evolution, and, you know, but he does, he teaches from that transcendent perspective, and that's his karma, and I'll also say that's his dharma, like that's his gift.
Right.
You know, but, you know, if you live long enough, what you'll notice is that vast spaciousness, it'll start to come down into your form. It feels like it's in your form when it happens. It feels like your form is spaciousness. But the awakening will actually descend down into your heart area, down into your torso. And, you know, a lot of dirt will start to get kicked up. A lot of things will be brought into the light. You'll see all the aspects of your humanity. Well, which have been ignored, denied, you know.
I just want to ask if there was something that you did to transition from this transcendent awareness or this transcendent stage of your awakening into the more grounded stage that you're talking about now.
Yeah, I did this very divine thing. I made an absolute and total ass of myself, fool of myself. I had an egoic nature that was still alive and well, you know. How about that's what I did? So, and that's what everyone does. You'll find it, you know, you'll find like, you know, my good friend Francis Bennett, he seems to have like a full-time job having to argue with people who are in the transcendent, and he's trying to bring them down into a more heart-centered experience and integrated experience. And, you know, I don't know how successful he is. I hope he laughs, you know, if he ever heard me say it, but, you know, he has people attacking him all day long because, you know, he's trying to teach from this other place that's deeper and more inclusive of our humanity. And, you know, to me, it's just like, you can only be a non-dual, I'll just call it transcendent Nazi, for so long before your friends and family start poking you and say, hey, like, I know no one's home, but, you know, you haven't paid your child support, you don't have a job, you're living at home. Or it's cool you have a trust fund and you can live in that way, but, you know, there are others around here who experience real live suffering.
Yeah.
And the earth is suffering. And, you know, so, you know, like my friend Rick Archer, he said when he was at the Science and Non-Duality Conference, he heard a teacher say, you know, when someone asked a question about global warming, he said, well, the earth doesn't really exist anyway, so, like, you know, like, why do we care? Or, you know, something like that, you know, and of course I don't want to quote someone who I wasn't there. And, but, you know, Rick kind of said, you know, and the audience was just like, ooh, like that's not an integrated approach.
Well, it just doesn't feel right. Yeah. When you
it doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
In your heart.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel right in your heart. And so for most of us, our humanity will come forward and it will invade that vast spaciousness. They'll kind of like knock on that door and say of your, you know, vast spacious awareness and say, hey, you know, you don't have any money, or hey, you know, you need to go to court, you know, or hey, you know, there's something here, you know, that needs your attention. Sometimes people will get really sick, you know, they'll get cancer and they'll be like, oh, wow, I do have a body, and it's actually really hurting, you know, or their wife or husband will leave them. And so life, because again, life is the force of evolution, will bring something forward, you know, something that we have to face. And there'll be a lot of people who will try to just stay in that transcendent space and say, oh no, that is just egoic stuff. I can't go there because that's messy. And they'll guard that transcendent space with their life because, oh, it feels so good and it feels so free. And, you know, if you have an ego likes a really pleasurable, open place. It doesn't like, you know, to experience anything unpleasant. But, you know, at some point, it's like life will catch up with us because life is evolution. And so, you know, either the, you know, our humanity comes up and meets the vast spaciousness, or this, I like the feeling of the spaciousness descending into our humanity. And then from that place of clarity, you know, we can see, oh look, there are aspects of my humanity which need some love, need some compassion, need some attention. Oh, maybe I need some discipline here. Oh, maybe I need to go and speak with a therapist about how I talk to myself, or my inner critic is still really loud. You know, when you first step into transcendence, oftentimes many things disappear for a period of time. And many people falsely mistake that as liberation, because it feels like liberation. It feels like everything just disappeared. Like when I was laying on the couch, I didn't have a care in the world. You know, there's like, I just felt like vastness in every direction. And, you know, it's incredible. It's like, oh wow, everything disappeared. There's nothing to do. No problem to solve. No ego to fix. You know, and it feels wonderful. It's like, aha, I've made it. I have arrived. You know, if we're really arrogant, we can say, oh, look at me. Now's the time for me to start teaching. You know, and many people make that mistake. But you know, life doesn't let us get away with it.
Right.
You know, our humanity will come forward. And, you know, so my humanity came forward again. I said, oh, okay, look at this. And look at that. And look at this thing over here. And so, you know, so I, you know, saw many therapists, many healers, many counselors, studied many healing modalities. You know, but it was all happening. Not like ego working with ego, but happening from vast spacious presence and with compassion. And so then the healing and the transformation is so much more efficient, you know, than, and that's one of the things that I shouldn't say sell myself on, but if you go see a therapist, you know, oftentimes a therapist, like, they'll meet you from this place where, you know, it's like they have this wall up and they're like examining you and they're writing little notes like, okay, this person has this disorder and that disorder, and you see the individual is inherently broken. That's kind of how like an ego works with another ego.
Right.
But the way I work with an individual is I connect first and foremost with their heart, with their divinity. And from that place, we look at our humanity. And say, oh, what's there? Oh, you know, I'm struggling with this. Okay. Well, how would your heart respond to this pain? You know? Would your heart say, oh, that's ego and I should just get rid of that or transcend it? No, your heart naturally meets every aspect of your humanity with love.
Yeah, in fact, in your book, you talked about dealing with some of these uglier aspects we find in ourselves as like a child who you would say, come up here and sit on my lap and let me love you and let me just be with you and just hold the space for you.
Absolutely. And that's how we heal. You know, we heal the same way, you know, we raise a child. You know, if you're a good father, you have total faith and trust in your son or daughter. Absolute faith and trust in them. You love them to the day they die. You believe in them. You are continually broadcasting this message. It's okay. Whatever happens, it's okay. We'll get through this. That's actually the experience of vast, spacious emptiness. That's the experience of, you know, this transcendent nature. It's okay. a good mother does this other aspect where she totally embraces the pain, holds you while you cry, meets you heart to heart, lets you cry your eyes out, and just holds you, accepts you, fully allows you to be the way you are. And when you're met with those two forces of totally being embraced and totally knowing that you're okay, you heal. That's how human beings grow. That's how they heal. Yes, if we've just through good parenting, you know, we end up being a very healthy individual. Of course, most of us didn't have perfect parents, you know. It's an unrealistic expectation to have perfect parents. But as a spiritually mature individual, if we're connected with our heart, and if we're connected with our truth, with our backbone, we naturally parent ourselves, our humanity, sweet, our childlike nature, in a loving and a compassionate and disciplined way. Yeah. Not a mean way, not a transcendent way. But if you look at transcendence of trying to ignore our humanity, that's an act of violence. Can you imagine walking into a room with a crying child and just ignoring her?
Yeah.
That's incredibly brutal.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's how most spiritual people, actually most people on the planet, work with their humanity. You know, they try to ignore it, whether through drugs and alcohol, through being a workaholic, through, you know, ignoring it through surfing the internet or whatever. You know, it's like, people are terrified of facing their humanity. And it's silly because we're the ones that suffer. And so it takes courage to go into these worlds and to really work with ourselves. But if you really look at the heart, like if you're connected with your heart, there's really no other way. If you have a heart and you see pain, you walk in the direction of pain. If you're connected with your ego, you walk in the opposite direction of pain. And I think, you know, most people's spirituality is ego driven. And so that's why they love transcendence, because it seems like, okay, I'm walking away up and out of pain. Pain disappears. Everything's perfect. And then when their humanity comes back again, yeah, they often say, oh no, I made a mistake. I screwed up. I fell out of awakening. And, you know, I look at an individual and say, no, this is divine intervention. This is how it's supposed to be. You wake up and out of, and then down and into, you know. So the second great stage of awakening, of course it doesn't always go this way, but the second great stage is connecting with your heart, which is open and intimate with everything. And here people make a big mistake, as they say, oh, when I'm in my heart, it feels good, it feels blissful, it feels alive, it feels radiant. And that's true. It feels one with all of life. But if we really look at what does it mean to be one with all of life? One with all of life means that you feel and experience everything. And most people don't like this teaching. They say, well, I like to feel the transcendent. I like to feel that which is blissful. I like to feel that which is peaceful. But I don't like to feel, you know, that which isn't good. You know, that which doesn't feel good. But true non-duality includes everything.
Yeah.
So I tell people, you know, I cry almost every day. I experience tremendous suffering almost every day. And some people say, well, doesn't, you know, enlightenment or awakening mean the end of suffering? And I say, hell no. If your heart is open, you're going to feel a million times more. I feel the pain of my students. I feel the pain of my wife. I feel the pain of my crying three-year-old. I feel the pain of my own heartache from my own experiences in life, how I feel the pain of the planet, you know. But simultaneously, it's happening within the space of vast, spacious emptiness. And so to truly be awake, you have to be a courageous soul who's willing to feel and experience everything. Oneness means oneness. It's one with everything. It's one with, you know, IS, it's one with terrorists, it's one with people in prison and rapists and murderers, and it's also one with the greatest thinkers and visionaries on the planet. It's one with the sky, one with the mountains, the trees, the, you know, it's one with everything. And so to be open in this way, you have to be willing to feel. You know, if you're awakening, if you want it to be full. Most spiritual people I know, I hate to say this, but they're like wet noodles, you know, or they're bliss buddies. They just want to feel what feels good. They have no spine or no backbone. So anytime something feels bad, they say, oh, that's negative. I don't like that. And it's like, do you think God says, I don't like negativity? God created negativity, war, disease, you know, terror. God created everything. And God is eternally in love with everything. And includes and accepts everything. And actually floods and radiates everything, animates everything. But simultaneously, God is a movement of intelligence and evolution. That's ever growing into higher and more complex and expansive expressions of divinity.
Let me ask you. First of all, my friend Kathy asked how others were around you, how they were reacting when all you wanted to do was hang out on the couch on your back porch.
Yeah, so they were. My children were upset, and rightly so. Anyone should have been upset. But people around me, I kind of just made myself, I just hung out with my kids and worked as little as I possibly could and hung out at my house. And so there wasn't very many people around me. I didn't talk about it. I didn't show it. I didn't try to show it off. I just, and to me it was one of those things where, I probably should have gotten back to work sooner, but I didn't and I couldn't. And so, it's like we can only play with should so long. Like I was literally blown to pieces. And so, a lot of my mind fell away. A lot of my memories fell away. I still have this problem now. I'll see someone in the street who's a good friend of mine and they'll come up to me and they'll say, "Hey, Craig," and start talking. And, it'll take me a couple minutes to remember their name or know who they are, or it happens to me all the time. I have a sky-like mind, and my wife tells me, she's like, "Craig, you can't remember anything." Trying to think like what did I do yesterday, and it's just a sense of spacious emptiness.
Yeah.
And so when it first came on, it was like having a head injury, and a lot of people thought I had a head injury. But I didn't at that time. But anyways, so yeah, it was. I'll even say this: it was blissfully wonderful, but it. My God, was it terribly inconvenient?
Yeah.
Because I had no money. I was selling off. How I had to sell off my car and my truck and things that were dear to me. Well, just to have money to live.
I keep finding myself wanting to go back and ask other questions, and then I don't get all my questions asked. What I really want to ask, but so let me focus on this. What I really want to ask about is, you talked about enlightenment as being intimacy with all things. You said intimacy is the direct, visceral experience of oneness, and that just really struck me because we all know what intimacy feels like.
Yeah.
Do you have more that you would like to say on that subject?
Yeah, I think I spoke a lot of it. I spoke a lot about that intimacy. In the beginning, the intimacy was with vast, spacious emptiness. But as that intimacy opened in the heart, at first it was like tremendous love. Like I can remember just walking down the street one day and it was fall. And the colors just felt so alive and so vivid. I'm going to use a very strange analogy here, but if anyone who's done drugs, who's done LSD, the colors become quite alive and vibrant. It's like, or if anyone's seen that movie Avatar, where the guy goes to like that other world, where just like everything is alive and just radiating with light. Well, hell. When that first opened in the heart, that's what it's like. It's like everything is so brilliant and alive. And at some point, you know, it just becomes, you know, a way of being in the world, that intimacy where I can fall in love with, you know, a wall, like a brick wall or, you know, a pile of dirt on the ground or just, you know, a trash can or just anyone. At first it was so crazy because any person I saw, I would just fall in love with them. You know, men and women, and of course, you know, I wasn't inappropriate in any way. I have very strong boundaries, but I would just see people and just be like, my God, they are so beautiful, because just the radiance. And even ugly people. I remember I was on a retreat once, and I was with this lady, and she was staying next to me, and she was, you know, big and overweight, and, you know, she looked at me and said, Craig, I'm an ogre. And I looked at her, and I said, my God, like, I love you so much. You are so beautiful. And she started crying when I said it. And also, I think she thought I was crazy, you know. But there's just that sense of just like falling in love with everything.
Yeah.
And so there's that experience on one side. And on the other side, and you know, not that there are sides, but right. was you, I would be crying terribly. When I would see a child, you know, in pain, or, you know, a picture of a child who was starving, or, you know, you hear about a friend with cancer, and tears would just pour out of my eyes. And still, you know, sometimes people come and sit in my office, or I'll see them on Skype. If they're in pain and they're not crying, if they want to cry but they're not, tears will just start coming from my eyes because I have that intimate experience with their pain. And, you know, for a while that got in too, because people are like, geez, this guy, like, you know, he'll just start crying, or, you know, or he'll start laughing just like hysterically. And yeah, things got weird for a while, but as it integrated and I became more accustomed to it, now I just feel, and you know, everything's still vibrant and bright and alive, but you know, I don't I'm not like, you know, like totally blown away by it, because it's just become normal. That's one of the things you know, Ajahn, my friend John Burney, we were talking about it. Said, yeah, at some point it just becomes normal.
Wow.
To experience this overwhelming intimacy with life. But there are times when, you know, like when I drive across the desert and I see the vast expanse of the sky, or if I climb a mountain, you know, I'll just start crying. I'll be like, it's just so beautiful. Or I'll go rock climbing with my friends and, you know, they're like pro rock climbers and they want to climb, do all these big climbs, and I'll just sit there and just stare at the mountain, and they'll be like, Craig, you want to climb this? And I'll just be like, I'm just going to sit here, you know, because our world is so beautiful.
Let me, Craig, we've got like 20 minutes left, so I want to open this
wow,
up.
Oh, I've done a lot of talking here.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's why you're here, right? That's good.
Yeah.
I want to open this up, though, to anybody who has any questions of you. You can ask, like Kathy did, ask your question on the board, or you can take the mic. For those of you who were here last month, we had a problem with the mic, but I think we're good to go this month. We've done several sound checks. So, guys, please feel free to ask Craig some questions while we have him here. I will say, while we wait, and again, I'm looking for you guys to raise your hands, but I will ask you another question.
Well, there's one more thing I could
right.
add
Very
about,
good.
You know, there's the first, say, two stages, the, you know, what I call like the head, the transcendent, the heart, the incredible intimacy. The third stage of awakening, which is, I think, much rarer and the least understood, you know, is oftentimes what's referred to as, you know, awakening in the gut or the falling away of the self. You know, when we start to embrace all the pain within us, we start to do it in a way where there's no reservation between, you know, wanting to experience that which is good and that which doesn't feel good. When we start to walk through our core wounds and deeper experiences of trauma, what I'll call like the fundamental experience of existential insecurity, which is at the heart of every ego. It's kind of like a screaming no to life, an existential fear of death. But this awakening, it descends deeper and deeper into us. And oftentimes we're faced with like an experience of jumping off a cliff. You know, it's like complete and utter fear comes forward. And again, most people will have an experience of just utter terror. And it may go on for weeks or months or even years, this experience. And, you know, this is post-awakening. This voice will come forward within an individual. And, you know, we'll be brought into that. Brought into that existential fear. You know, one of the things, the way the Buddha described this is the groundless nature of existence. And it's almost like you'll be just pushed off this cliff. And for me, you know, it's like facing fear, just utter existential terror for months on end. And as you let go into it, you know, through a movement of faith and trust, and you're also just kind of pushed off into it. At this point, it's not like you're doing anything. You let go into this vast experience of an indestructible nature, of being one with life, but in a different way, where fear has dissolved, insecurity has dissolved, and duality has dissolved. When you've had the first two awakenings, even though it feels as if there can't be duality anymore, it's really in the third one that duality disappears. You know, where the feeling of, you know, having a like or a dislike or a, you know, a bias against pain really changes. You know, I tell people all the time, I love pain. There's not a sense of pain being bad or wrong. There's not a sense of death being wrong. There's not even a sense of that I could die. There's this really eternal nature that comes forward that's filled with strength, filled with autonomy. Our spiritual ego tends to dissolve at this point. It's quite profound, and it's incredibly silent. It's like the silence deepens into the very fabric of our being and the fabric of this world. It's really interesting because we start to see things in a new way, where I remember I saw like the Japanese tsunami come forward and it like destroyed a village. You know, I saw it on the news. And there was just a sense of, this is God too. It's totally okay.
Wow.
And it's brutal to admit something that like that, like cancer is okay, war is okay, death is okay. It's like when my father died, you know, there was this sense like in my heart, my humanity was grieving him, but it was held in this absolute container of, it's completely and totally okay. And I, you know, I really questioned this for a while. I can even remember going to Ajahn and telling him about this and wondering, like, you know, am I really fearless in the eyes of death? And, you know, I thought, you know, I guess I won't really know until I die. But I had this experience, you know, a couple weeks after talking to him, where I was my father died, and then I met up with some friends and they wanted to take me whitewater rafting, and it's like the biggest day of the year on the river with the, you know, the highest rapids. We're in this little boat, and I was in the boat for about 3 minutes. We went through these huge rapids. I got thrown out and sucked under. I actually got my head smashed by the oarlock as it flipped over. And I got sucked under these rapids and beat up by all these rocks. And all of a sudden everything went silent, and I just thought, oh, okay, like, this is death, like, and there was just total and complete peace there. It was wonderful. It was like, there was no fight with it. And, I say this now, unfortunately, I was spit back out.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Yeah, you guys might be glad. But then, you know, I had this head injury and it, you know, experienced tremendous pain in my body for the next, couple years. But there was just a sense of, even death is totally and completely okay. And that was a real, well, it's just a real powerful realization for me, even though it came through an act of, a terrible experience, so. So anyways, did anyone have a question?
No, I do not see anyone raising their hand. We'll extend that invitation again. Let me ask you, given the limited time that we have left. Guys, really, raise your hands, though, if you have a question. What advice you would give to someone seeking awakening, enlightenment, seeking the self? What advice would you give to us today?
Wow, what advice. I think the best advice is for you to listen to your own heart. We all have this truth within us. We all have God as our nature. I think so many of us on the spiritual path, we field questions to our mind. We're always asking our mind, which is inherently confused, or it has like a couple different lawyers in it arguing different points, Okay, I got this perspective and that perspective, this perspective or that way. And that's the dualistic nature of the mind, is this or that, this or that. So we have those voices. Sometimes we'll have three or four voices just in our mental mind. And then in our emotional nature, we have these drives, saying, I want to go this way, or I should go that way, or this feels good, or this feels terrible. But deeper than all those voices is just this quiet, still presence in our heart. And anything we ever truly ask ourselves, we'll always get the answers from the mind, from the emotional arena. But if we just become quiet and just ask our heart, what's true? What's true for me? What's my next step? What do I need to do? The answer always comes forward. The trick is, though, it's the quietest voice within us. It's the stillest voice within us. Whereas our mind, it tends to be really loud. We have those inner critics, the lawyers that argue, the emotions that pull at us. And that's really one of the things that happens in that third level of awakening, is all those different minds, the things that can argue with themselves, they all dissolve and there's just this one voice left. And it's really wonderful, because then there's not that inner division. We look at what true enlightenment is. It's to be undivided. And so it's quite wonderful to have this practice anywhere we are on the journey of just, can we listen to our heart? If we place our power and attention there, we go quite quick on the path. If you're someone like me who was incredibly divided, confused, angry, disgruntled, I would listen to my heart for half of a second and then choose to follow guilt or anger or, what I think I should do or what's best because I'm being a pleaser to whoever. And we can spend a whole lifetime, just spinning ourselves in circles when we already know the truth. And so I can say this funny thing too, that after we go through all these stages of awakening, we no longer feel as if we are awake and everyone else is asleep. When we look out at the world, we see that everyone is enlightened. Everyone is awake. Everyone is absolutely divine. And they have this truth. This truth is moving through them in the form of evolution. They have their hearts, which are beautiful and have the same truth and any great sage is in, any regular, ordinary individual. And that division between being awake and being not awake, I don't even think in those terms anymore. I just assume everyone is awake. And then sometimes they prove to me how confused they are about this or that. But, there's no judgment about it. It's part of being a human and being in this world. We're all going to be somewhat confused because we're evolving into something greater. But beyond being confused, there's something so beautiful that animates all of us. And the big joke is, after you go through it and walk through these doors, it's just like, awakening, like, who cares? We're all awake. We're all divine. It's all already here. And there's not like a sense of moral superiority or like, I know something someone else does. You just have a sense that everyone knows this, but sometimes they don't listen to their heart, you know? And so,
so you think we all already know whatever there is to know and can get
absolutely
in touch with that and have the means and the ability to do it now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're all God.
Yeah.
We're all God. Every single human being and beyond human beings is plants, animals, everything. Like hell, sometimes I sit down with my dog and I just feel the presence of God pouring through him.
Let me ask you this though. There are many of us who seem to be looking for something. I mean, that's we're spiritual students. We seem to be looking for something, and maybe I'm looking in the wrong direction and from the wrong perspective. But it seems like there's a process that you've gone through that I haven't gone through. And so what I'm asking for from you is some guidance as to how to best facilitate that process.
Sure.
You've told me spend more time in my heart.
Sure. So spend some people really misunderstand when I say spend more time in the heart. People think of their emotional heart.
Right.
And to me, the emotional heart is a dangerous place. If you feel on the center of your chest, like that's like the outside of the heart chakra, that's where the emotional heart lives. But if you go deeper back toward the spine, you'll feel this quiet presence of radiance.
Yeah.
And so it's listening to that. It's feeling into that. It's honoring that. And then it's allowing that to manifest through your life. And so what does that look like?
Yeah.
In spiritual practice?
Yes, sir.
Well, hell, I'm a big fan of meditation. I meditate every day, you know, I haven't missed a day in 20 years. And so, you know, I recommend, you know, an hour or more a day. Some people think that's crazy. Some people think that's too little. Spending time in silence, continually just like unhooking from your mind and dropping into your heart, feeling into what's true, asking what's true, asking what place am I living my life from. So it's like sitting with these questions. You know, a really, really wonderful one that I like is to have people look into the mirror, to look directly into your own eyes. You know, just like as I look into your eyes across the computer screen, I feel this radiance, this divinity. Can you feel that radiance? Can you feel that beauty? Can you say, is this beauty ever not here? Is it ever not here? Is this radiance ever not here? How could this radiance, this aliveness that I am, ever not be here? And so as human beings, we have a choice, you know? It's like, where do we want to place our attention?
Yes.
You know, do I want to place it on this silly story I have in my head about this or that? Or do I want to place it on my divinity? It's like you place it on your divinity, that becomes your way of being and living in the world. You place it on your mind, and hell, that grows. You know, it's like, I know people who watch, you know, Fox News 12 hours a day, and they become angry and disgruntled, you know, because it's people arguing with each other about news. You watch CNN news and have that experience of angry and disgruntled.
Right.
You know, have the news station blaring into your consciousness in every moment. But people miss this thing, you know. It's like we're fish swimming around in water and we don't see the water. It's like we are walking in radiant spaciousness in every moment. It's one of the things that came alive in my journey one day. I just discovered, oh, like you can see space. You can see it. It's everywhere. It's like the space of the room, the space of your mind. It's radiant. It's alive.
Wow.
It's beautiful. It's not like I did anything special. I just did what my teacher said. You know, meditate, turn awareness upon itself. Okay, if you become aware of that which is aware, what is that? Like, what is that? It's quiet. It's spacious. It's alive. Okay. You know, so I went to my teacher, said, okay, I discovered this. He said, well, put your attention there. Keep it there. And then it grows. If you ignore it, it's still there. You just don't see it. You just don't notice it. You have Fox News in your head, or you have rock and roll in your head, or you have, I'm surfing Facebook, random pictures of random people who I kind of know going through my head, you know? Right. And so it's just like, what kind of life do you want? As a kid, you know, like I knew there was always something greater. And so my heart was like always just like kind of looking to it, looking to the night sky, looking to nature, looking in spiritual books, you know, chasing gurus, you know. But at some point, it was wonderful when I just learned to turn awareness upon itself. And it was like, oh, it's here within me. And then when there was the realization, it's here within me, there was simultaneously the realization of, oh, it's here within everything.
Wow. Yeah.
If we stop at, it's here within me, well, we can become very arrogant and egotistical. But we discover, oh, and the beautiful thing about when I discovered it within myself was I kind of hated me. I was trying to get rid of me. Mm. And so when you discover it within the thing that you kind of hate, it's really healing.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh,
wow,
right here, right everywhere.
This awareness, watching awareness is something that we've been working with. And my experience is that that's taking some practice. There's an act to that, an art to that.
Yeah, it takes discipline. And, you know, a lot of non-dual teachers don't talk about discipline, but I am a huge fan of discipline. But the way I've learned to work with discipline is I call it gentle discipline. You know, in the past, I used to meditate kind of like with my fists closed and just like this intensity of trying to like, you know, find the right experience. But what I realized is, oh, that's way too tight. You know, it's just like a relaxed opening.
Right.
Like a gentle feeling into what is the aliveness of my being feel like? And to really include your whole body, what does it feel like in my feet, in my knees, in my thighs, in my pelvis, in my belly, in my heart, in the space of my mind? Like, hell, even if I feel into my hands right now, I just feel like power and Shakti just pouring out of them. And again, none of this is because I'm special. If I feel into anyone's hand, sense of, can I feel that which is alive within me? And can I fall in love with myself?
Sweet.
Can I fall in love with that? The other choice is, again, to space out on Facebook and scroll through mindless images of whatever, or just like see life through like, you know, like our analytical mind. And to me, if I try to step into my analytical mind, like if I have to do my taxes or something and invoke that part of my nature, it hurts like hell. It feels like taking yourself being vast and huge and just reducing it into, you know, this tight, tense little thing. But can you just feel into your nature? Oftentimes people think of awareness as just in their head, but hell, awareness is throughout your form. You know, if you're sitting in a room and I walk into it, even if you don't hear me or see me, if I walk in from behind, you know, there'll be part of you that will have a sense that, oh, there's something here. You know, there's someone in the room with me. You know, if I come and step on your toe, that's awareness in your feet. It's not just nerves. It's a sense of aliveness and divinity that's there. And so can we be awake to all of this? That's an incredible practice. I mean, hell, if most of us just did that, we'd wake up real quick.
Good.
We don't have to read any books or do anything, but just notice what it's like to be alive and to fall in love with it.
Well, thank you. It looks like we are we're out of time. I want to tell the folks who are here, I want to give them your website address, and that is, you tell us.
It's CraigHoliday.com, so just my name. And Holiday has two L's in it. I think if you do one L, you might get a financial coach or something like that.
That's
but
not it.
Craig Holiday with two L's. com. And so there's information about my work, all kinds of blog articles. I think a couple chapters of my book might be posted there, some of my teachings, some upcoming retreats I'm doing. I think the next one I'm doing is in Sweden, so that might be far away for a lot of the listeners, but I'm going to start trying to do some more stuff locally here in Colorado. And, of course, I'm open to traveling. I just came back from teaching in North Carolina at a festival, and that was quite wonderful. And so if anyone's interested in these teachings, please send me an email and get a hold of me. And if they want to meet by Skype for a Skype session, I'll be happy to connect in that way, too. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Craig. We really enjoyed you. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. And I am I'm gonna let go of the mic, guys, and they're saying thank you, and Regina says she will email you in a couple days. She's okay. Going to the San Luis Valleys. So
Oh, okay, good.
All right, so I'll let go of the mic for them.